You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Bald Move Television Podcast. We're the officially unofficial podcast for all of television. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And I'm Cecily.
And we are here to talk about three new shows that debuted on television this week. Catch 22, a Hulu original, dropped a whole season on us. It's a comedy, dramedy, starring, George Clooney and Hugh Laurie. And what's that guy's name?
His name is Christopher Abbott.
Christopher Abbott. We also looking at Fleabag, which returns for season two, but we're going to talk about it anyway because there's no rules. It's all television we're covering here. And finally, the HBO documentary, sports documentary, Muhammad Ali, Say My Name. We'll be discussing that in this order. Guys, let's start with Hulu's Catch 22.
I watched one episode.
This is 6 45-minute episodes. They all dropped today. They're all available. Are you guys, either of you guys familiar with the original, the novel, the source material?
No, I didn't even know there was one.
I'm not either. It's one of those things that's like kind of hard to get out of a literature class in high school without being familiar with it, but somehow
right.
Mooresville didn't carry it in their curriculum. But it's essentially about a guy who is a bomber.
Dropped
the bombs on the bomber planes in World War II, and his feelings about war and being stuck with it and the madness and the crazy things that happen and him trying to get out of fighting that war. And Catch-22 refers to the, I'm not sure if it's real or if this is a farcical military doctrine that they actually succinctly state this, like the army can says that if appropriate fear and concern for one's safety in a dangerous situation is a rational response. So just being afraid to go out on these bombers is a sane thing. So, but also you don't have to fly the bombers if you're crazy. But the second you say you're crazy, so you can get out of, you're making a rational thought process. So then you're no longer crazy and you have to fly the planes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the catch 22. It's a hell of a catch. What'd you guys think about it? Especially like did it successfully navigate the kind of rough waters of comedy and drama dealing with like the horrors of war and also just kind of funny life in the military type stories?
Yeah, I really think it did. I felt like those bomber scenes were pretty harrowing. Even the ones that go right and then nobody dies. I felt very much the fear that the bomber was feeling in any given moment.
Right, even in like the scene where they were doing the test with the pilot or their instructor.
Yeah.
It still had, you could just feel that tension there.
And they do a good job of everybody kind of on the radios going, hurry the fuck up, let's mm-hmm. get this done,
like,
look,
you know,
at the
yeah.
hellscape we're in, drop those bombs. And he's like, nope, just hold, I need to get line this up or this mm-hmm. is for nothing and we're gonna have to go out and do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all that stuff worked. And then the comedy stuff, I thought, was almost just a nice bonus.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't find it super hilarious, but I did enjoy it. And
yeah.
I'm looking forward, although I will say I don't think we've seen the best of George Clooney or Hugh Laurie.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to more with them.
I don't think we'll see George Clooney ever again.
No?
Yeah, the swimmer character.
See, the drill sergeant.
Yeah, he was like the drill sergeant that got him whipped into shape, and now
okay.
I actually don't even know if we'll see Hugh Laurie anymore. I kind of feel like those were big cameos that were there to kind of, you know, it's a George Clooney production, so throwing him in there, you know, kind of gets people's butts in the seats for Hulu, and then I feel like both of those characters are dismissed early on. Hmm.
I think they'll all come back.
Yeah.
Or both of them. I think it kind of the theme, and it's pretty obvious, but I think the theme is the circular logic of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's only 9 more missions left, but now you've got 5 more tacked on, and it's just going to keep repeating.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like those people are going to come back and sort of the exact same way throughout this person's experience. But I don't know. I haven't read the book.
I think if this is a fake military doctrine and it's not real, they really should have called the show and potentially the book. I don't know what the name of that is, but Catch 25 would actually be a better
Why Catch 25?
Because they have to run 25 missions, right?
Oh. Well, now they
and
have
everybody
to run
knows Catch 22, and so they would kind of infer the circular logic of it all. But
I thought, because there's a lot of other things, like I found myself being charmed by, like, there's this character named Milo, and he has this pitch for being a mess officer because everyone's trying to work. It seems like there's a couple characters trying to work angles to keep them out of flying these dangerous bombing missions.
Sure.
And I'm like, because they make this Hugh Laurie when you see this guy, this major that runs this air wing. He's very cultured, and he, you know, like if he was a millennial, he'd be ordering toast with avocado. He's got he's got like a record player set up playing, you know, high class music, and he's got a horseshoe pitch, which is kind of low class, but you just kind of get that he's kind of this type of guy who wants his rack of lamb and his exotic eats and his exotic drinks, and there's this guy here to provide it for him. But then I feel like he's replaced in this episode, like this new hard charging guy is put over it, and this other guy gets sidelined. I'm like, why? I was really getting invested in this Milo and his rise to mess officer. What's going on here?
What is Hugh Laurie's rank? Because I know that other guy's a colonel, right?
I thought they were both majors. Hugh Laurie's for sure.
I thought
he said
I'm colonel. Something.
Maybe, yeah, you could be right. The other guy's lieutenant colonel.
I don't, and I also don't know the structure of
yeah. I was making surmise like when. You're right. I might be wrong. That might be like middle management.
Yeah,
I don't
missed
know
the titles.
I'm hoping that they can coexist because I love Hugh Laurie after years and years of House and just, you know, his British comedy stuff. I would like to see him come back.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The comedy's all very just understated.
Yeah.
Especially his stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because like when we were first watching this and I was kind of familiar with the source material, Catch 22, at least I knew what it was thematically. And I'm like, you know, we had this interesting conversation yesterday on the spoiler podcast about like kind of pacifism and, you know, what extreme pacifism looks like and whether we kind of agree with it. And when this started up, I'm like, oh, this guy's like a pacifist to the extent that you won't, like, if you won't fight against Nazi Germany, I don't know that there's a fight that you that feels morally justified. I'm like, this is going to be interesting to see how I can, you know, because I guess I can be sympathetic for anyone that doesn't want to fight war because you're afraid and no one wants to die and etc. But like, if there's a reasonable case that there's some kind of existential crisis and you don't fight against something that's broadly considered one of the greatest evils of the 20th century, then like, how sympathetic am I going to be to this person? But then you find out that like, even though he's extremely feeling this fear and he tries to get out of it in any way he can, like he's not going to shirk. Like, he's not the type of guy who like dropped the bombs early. Like, he takes the job seriously. And then, you know, when he finds out that like he's just counting down to 25, then they arbitrarily add 5 more missions and they talk about like, oh, when you're done in Germany, you're going to go to Japan. And he'd make some good points like, hey, yeah, we've got Germany on the ropes. Like, why are we still doing this? And we're risking lives to, because why again? Yeah. I thought those were interesting things. Bravery, courage, pacifism.
What kind of man is the, how do you say his name? Yosefaria, something like that?
Yo-Yo.
Well, what kind of man is he? Is he a good man? Because there's nothing wrong with not wanting to do these bombing missions. But he's also sleeping with his, I want to say Officer Clooney.
Cucking George Clooney.
Yeah.
He is. I didn't think that was possible, frankly, but, you know.
Just goes to show.
Clooney's getting up there.
Yeah.
And he accidentally sent the young new bunkmate Mud to his death.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, that was
Did
so
he
brutal.
Realize that? Did that 100% sink in with him?
Because
I didn't
sure.
really think he registered strongly enough, oh, I did this to this kid.
I don't think so
it
either.
It depends on how much he knew what was going on at that time, because he knew he sent him to the wrong tent.
Yeah.
Does he know what they were doing in there?
I can't
right.
believe.
Is that like, where everyone reports and they're right. told which ship to get on? Because then he would right. make that connection, right?
I assume he's going to find out later through some other avenue that, oh, I actually sent this kid to his death.
Or it could just be a kind of an illustration of how you know, you always this is interesting. Like they touch on with Band of Brothers too, like how there's this intense bond between the people that go through the shit, but then like when the replacements come, it's kind of like fuck this guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's on mission zero, and I'm on mission 19. Like, you know, but I just don't think he's evil. I don't think he would realize he sent that guy to his possible death and then not get up from his cot. I just feel like it's one of those things where he hasn't put two together. And I can see them making that a thing later on. And I can also see them just being like, this is a statement about the fog of war and how people sure. relate to each other and kind of how fucked up things can get.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where do you think this series is going? So we've seen the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we're spoiling that entire thing, but there are five more episodes.
Right. This is like spoiling the first 15 minutes of a movie. It's the setup. Yeah, this is all setup.
So where do you think this thing is going?
I have no idea, because like this felt like a very fully developed, like this could be another episode long and could finish, and I feel like it'd be a conventional kind of cinematic experience. Obviously there's five more rough hours of roughly 5 hours of television, I guess 4 hours of television ahead of us. I have no idea, because also how can they top this stuff? You know, we've seen like how this utterly terrifying, like
mm-hmm.
I've always thought it'd be terrible to be in these like rigid lines that the armies used to stand in, where you're standing shoulder to shoulder and you're like, you know, ready, aim, fire, reload, mm-hmm. ready, and then the other volley's coming, and just like how fucked up that is, that you're just standing there and people dying all around you. And it's like that World War II bombing campaign is almost exactly like that. Like men rigidly flying in formation through hell. And then you just hope that more of your bombs hit than they knock planes out of the sky. And how helpless. Like everyone in that situation is, like, except for the bomber. Like the pilot has to fly straight until the bomber says it's ready to go. And then once the bomber says it's go time, he's then helpless to do anything but be careful. It's and the way that he like looked over to his fellow like bomber gunner or whatever, and they like made eye contact and then explode. And like, I don't know if this has ever happened in World War II, but I believe it could happen. His body just slammed. That was fucked up.
Yeah, it is.
So like, that's a strong statement. But I mean, it seems clear that this guy, like, I think maybe that he will actually go crazy, and they'll be like, that'll be interesting.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, like, because you know the idea of a Catch-22 and the sort of it being the title tells me that A, they're going to go with the irony of it all, right? Which I think makes a lot of sense. But also, I think they're going to go with the genuine idea that these situations, you know, being, even if you're not crazy going into these situations, there's only a certain amount of shit that people can take.
Before they snap, yeah.
Yeah, and this guy, I mean, well, there's the very first shot of the episode, right? Where he walks in back into camp from some horrific experience, covered in blood and screaming, completely naked. I mean, is that's the end of the series, right?
Yeah, I forgot about
that. It's
gotta
be.
Yeah, you're right.
some kind of nightmare he's having because he's seen so much and he's gone crazy, like you said. I think it ends in either he goes crazy or maybe he makes an escape.
Well, because it seems like clear,
because he sees so much of this, maybe that scene happens and he just can't take it anymore.
Yeah, he's like 17 or 18 missions in, and clearly he's still sane. Like, if he got out now, he'd live a normal life. And also, you can't call him a coward. He flew through 19 combat missions of this shit. So it's like, but if the next 11 missions, like, if the Teresa is going to be like, you will do this thing until you become insane.
Mm-hmm. And also the pointlessness of it, too, because like you said, Germany is on the ropes, and like, he was made a promise, and now that promise is being altered, you know.
Yeah.
He got Darth Vader'd. I don't know.
And also, like, if you're telling that story, how are they going to keep it consistently funny? Because it's all fun to see this guy, you know, fucking George Clooney's wife as he's doing these pointless military drills, and this guy's doing his mess officer. But, you know, it's already, like, I think kind of harder for the show to be funny after they did the sequence where he got, you know, that guy's corpse got blown into the canopy. It's like Breaking Bad, you know. Breaking Bad could be darkly funny or very, very dramatic and invested, but like the latter hurt its ability to do the former, you know. So like,
yeah, and over time they drop that, yeah,
real grim places.
And I also wonder who I'm supposed to believe in some of these scenes. Like, it's clear that the main character has a somewhat nihilistic view of things. You know, he's talking about you know, he says he's not casting judgment on God, but he's simply pointing out facts. But he's talking about, oh, the cruelty of God and the scenario he's in. And then when they talk about these parades, I thought it was interesting because the one guy sees them as a team building exercise,
right?
To build camaraderie, build, you know, communication, all those kinds of things. The main character sees them as a display of power via the humiliation of the troops. So who am I supposed to believe in that moment? And what does that say about what's going to happen during the rest of the show?
But the thing is I think that the show wants you to think Yo-Yo is right because this character is consistently shown to be a dumbass. Or maybe he's actually right objectively, but his
being
correct
within the system
does not fit into the army's way of doing things.
Right. That's kind of how I viewed it. And I don't think that's... So saying that fitting into the system is a negative thing is not something that...
Yeah.
That I understand.
Uh-huh.
Or rather, sorry, I misspoke there. Saying that this person doesn't fit into the system isn't necessarily a negative thing to me.
Well, but like when you see the system is flying shoulder to shoulder, interlocked, never like budging and like just rigidly following this thing, even though everything in your body is screaming to turn the wheel, get the fuck out of here, like... That is how you do it. Like,
but he's so right about the other thing when he's talking about, oh, why can't you fucks get into formation correctly and do this march?
Right.
I mean, he's kind of right. You know, break down the teams into smaller groups, get them refined at the lower levels, and then build them up into a cohesive unit. Like, that all makes sense to me. So when they try to portray him as wrong about the purpose of the parades, I'm...
Maybe that's
not
a part of it.
It.
That's like a subtle nod to other mini catch-22s in life. Like,
yeah,
if you... You've got this training process is regimented and it's one size fits all and you're encouraged to not think outside the box. So the people you want, like your officers, but to be dashing and creative and problem solvers. But you've got a system that's designed to stamp out round pegs that fit in a round hole.
Yeah.
So like a guy who's actually intelligent and thinks about the problem would not make it through that process. And you get a guy like George Clooney, who's just like, he wants you guys to swing 7 inches. Or 3.5-inch arc from hip to wrist, and God damn it, why can't you do it? Whereas a person, it's like, well, here's why you can't. You're a fucking square peg, and I'm trying to pound you in a round hole. Shut the fuck up. That's a catch 22. Like a person,
and then the further catch 22 is when you get to be an officer, right? And they actually do want you to display all the qualities
they
that they beat the fuck out of you over the course of your training. Yeah,
that's what I was thinking. Like, how does Hugh Laurie go from being in like those petty officer ranks to getting up to being an officer?
And then turning into the person he is,
it makes me think that they didn't. That most of the officers...
It didn't work on him? Or
no, that they didn't go through that at all. They started off...
Oh, I think you have to.
I don't...
Yeah, I think in the military, everybody goes through that initial training, and the people get promoted through that.
I thought there was, like, you got enlisted, and then you've got officer. Like, there's, like, a... You can
yeah, but don't
list-
they come out of like aren't you?
Some
don't you
people,
get to officer training via just a standard boot camp kind of?
Yeah, I think there's like a, like so you can get like a battlefield commission, but then there's also officer training school, and that's like where the majority of them come out of. But I don't,
I don't know enough, obviously.
I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, maybe he didn't go through that. Maybe that's why he's got these eccentricities about his personality.
Yeah,
right. Someone like. Gosh, I wish I had their character names.
I know. And that's the one criticism I had is like, I found it very hard to tell these guys apart.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them are like sandy blonde haired with regulation haircuts and they're all wearing the uniforms. And
right. Even with them helpfully going through and giving us the text version of their names next to their faces, still nothing registered.
Yeah.
But yeah, someone like George Clooney's character seems like he came through it. He believes in it strongly. Mm-hmm. Even if there's a new way, that's how it's always been done, and that's how he got to be a disciplined man, so why would we change it now?
Changes in those kind of procedures come from the top. Like, they don't just, you know, oh, we're going to try something new today, kids. Nope.
But to your point, it seems like with the formation and humiliating the people, and who was right... It seems like the guy who had the idea about the smaller groups was proven wrong when he locked his knees and passed out. It's like this.
I don't know why.
I don't understand why that happened. Do you?
Yeah, it's a thing that happens when you get nervous. But if you're standing straight up and you lock your knees, it'll
impair your circulation.
Yeah, it'll impair your circulation. It'll make you pass out. Yeah. It's something I learned when I was in choir. Because a lot of people, when they go to perform for the first time, they're trying to like really focus on their posture because that's what you've been told all along. Mm. So you're so focused on keeping this rigid posture, you cut off your own circulation and then just pass out.
Yeah. All right. I wasn't sure if they were leaning towards that because I'd heard the same thing or if it was just like it was hot.
I feel like you could tell in the way he started to shake before he fell. Like his, you could see his legs starting to shake.
Right.
And, you know, the tuba is very heavy. He shouldn't have been carrying that.
Right. That was foolish.
What do you guys think of the star Christopher Abbott? Because I didn't think much of him, honestly, in Girls, but I've seen that he's done a lot of interesting things lately. He was in First Man. He's coming up with this new Natalie Portman, Jude Law, Vox Lux type of musical deal. I thought that he was really, really good in this show.
I agree.
So I don't know. Cause I'd heard some stuff like with something went bad between him and the Girls production and that like he either demanded to be out or maybe they didn't want him to come back. And I don't know, but like I said, I didn't think much of him in that show, but like I've seen him, I can't remember the last time I saw him in something. But I really like him in this and I'm looking forward to seeing him with, that Vox Lux thing coming out.
Yeah.
I thought another standout performance was the Doctor. I really enjoyed every scene that the Doctor was in.
Yes. When the Doctor was explaining the Catch-22 to Yo-Yo, it was actually a direct, you told me this, was a direct quote from the original novel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That whole line of dialogue, which I thought, like, man, it feels like a who's on first type of skit.
It does, yeah.
But yeah, it's just like, it's a word-for-word description of the character, like, articulating what Catch-22 is from the novel. The only difference is, in the novel, I guess he, like, whistled, like, when he found, instead of being like, that's some catch. but I like that. It had a lot of that kind of, like, frantic... little bit of off-kilter, like George Clooney, Men Who Stare in Goats kind of energy to it. I don't know whether I'm just saying that because it's George Clooney and I see him in a military uniform.
No,
and
I mean, I got the same impression, especially when it opens with a naked man walking on an airbase. I'm like...
Yeah, it feels farcical, but it's very serious. I'm very curious to see if they can continue kind of flipping this tone or it's just going to get grimmer and grimmer and grimmer. Hey, before I move on, I want to promote the club, club.baldmove.com, where you can get fantastic club content. It's interesting, on Fridays when we record this TV podcast, if we actually come fresh off of Lunch with Jim and Aaron, a series where Jim and I talk about whatever's on our mind, and we also turn the mics over to you, the audience, and they can ask us questions. And the highlight for the lunch for me today, Jim, was the legend of Cocaine Bear.
Oh, easily.
We're talking about our top five animals of all time, and someone mentioned there's a bear that ate 40 kilograms of cocaine and lived to tell the tale. Actually, that's not true. He totally died. His heart exploded and caught fire. But it's kind of a funny story. You can get it exclusively on Lunch with Jim and Aaron, one of the many club features. You can test drive the club by going to club.baldmove.com, or you can preview some lunches for free. See what it's all about. Always, you can start a new 30-day trial to get all club content risk-free, your money back if you're not satisfied. Start yours at club.baldmove.com today. Do you guys want to move on to Fleabag?
Let's do it.
So Fleabag is an Amazon original. It's moving on to season two. And we normally don't do season two stuff, but we were so kind of taken, I think, charmed by the trailer that we're like, you know what? Fuck it. We will check this episode out, or we'll check the season out. I noticed that they made like a 2-minute kind of like everything you need to know from season one kind of previously on, which I found not super helpful.
I was more confused at the end of that than I would have been without it.
Yeah, but I gotta say, I fucking love this episode. This felt so like emotionally real. Mm-hmm. I feel like when I was growing up, all of the sitcoms were essentially trying to show you how things should be. Like how like this is how families should interact, and this is how families should deal with problems, and this is how friends should support each other. And like nowadays, television series are like that generation grew up, and like this is how things actually were in the homes You know, we were watching.
It's like a Wonder Years kind of thing.
Yeah, we were watching. We were all watching like Family Ties and Silver Spoons and Growing Pains and the fucking Tanners and Full House. But what we were really living were these passive aggressive old generation versus new generation people walking on like these family dynamics. Like I just thought. I don't know. I thought it was very entertaining and kind of also insightful.
Yeah, this dinner scene, this whole dinner scene, and it's effectively like the whole episode is this dinner scene.
Yeah.
But in the beginning especially, I very much felt like I did with Russian Doll, where it's just like bombarding you with so much conversation you can't possibly take it in. The thing that I really loved about it is that was the point of it.
Yeah.
And that every smoke break she took was me taking my own fucking smoke break from this episode, and it really worked for me in that regard.
Yeah.
Where, you know, a lot of shows just play it straight, like, catch up.
Yeah.
Catch up, and I never want to catch up. This one was like, oh my God, it's so much.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I thought
reset.
It I just recently went down and spent some time with my dad in Florida, and we had kind of like a tense dinner situation where it's like I couldn't put my finger exactly what was ratcheting up the tension in every single thing, but like I kept on like, Jesus Christ, if politics comes up right now, it's gonna. But like this dinner was like that. Like every single thing seemed like, oh, you should be able to roll with that, but they just kept on piling on and piling on. Mm-hmm. And the editing is really good of like, you know. There's this one part where like her stepmom is, she's invited this Catholic priest who's a very unconventional Catholic priest, and he's swearing and he's talking.
Who may
about,
not even be a Catholic
might
priest.
Not, he might be a fake Catholic priest. Okay. I don't know. That's an interesting. It doesn't seem like from seeing the trailer that's actually the case, but he's just an unconventional Catholic priest. And her parents, which are kind of like oblivious and they're well-meaning, but they say stupid stuff. Like I feel like a lot of shows like this would have the
mom. I don't think they're that well-meaning.
Yeah, maybe, but she's the type of mom to be like, oh, anything. The interesting way about this the father so and so is his mother's originally a lesbian, and then it just smash cuts there like a 5 years
break,
ago.
Yeah.
This sitcom would just show everyone being uncomfortable, but now you just so this like you, it's like they flash forward 15 minutes in a conversation, knowing like, oh God, that's one of the things that's ratcheting the tension here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, just that's the fact good. That. You know, you would be that casual about revealing people's personal details, and the fact that it also be like a, you're saying interesting, but you're kind of using it to say shocking or scandalous. And I just thought the way to edit it and the way that the
right, this person is an extension of her, and this person, the more interesting that they are, the more interesting she becomes. Mm-hmm. You know, she was really seemed to clearly be hoping he was going to wear his little dog collar thing.
Yeah, yeah. Almost to say, look who I found.
Right, exactly.
Like showing off a pet. Yeah, that's.
Yeah, exactly like that.
Oh, a lot of the reason this works is this Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who I had never heard of before watching this, but
is
I guess.
Is that the main character?
She's the main character. She's the creator of the show. She's the writer of the show.
And she wrote the show Killing Eve, too.
This
which
is also
really
based
popular.
On, I guess, a stage play that she had written and performed. And she's also behind, she's the showrunner and head writer, I think, of the BBC Killing Eve, which I've heard a ton of good things about.
Yeah.
So, like, suddenly she just burst on, and, like, she's just great. Like, she does these fourth wall breaks that I find very, very funny and charming.
And very smooth, right. Too. Like,
yes.
There are moments, like, where she takes a breath and then, like, winks at the camera or something.
Yeah,
and,
like,
and,
I
right,
feel
like
I'm
you're sitting
her
at
best.
The table, too, and you're sharing the secret.
Yeah, like, yeah. I'm her bestie, and, like, we're catching eyes, like, kind of like, oh, yeah, your mom's a piece of work. Or,
yeah, super smooth.
Your dad. It's good. And like everything just like that happens is maximum like social awkward. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, your dad and her dad's like the most inarticulate man alive, but I love it because it feels like my dad who's like, you always seen this in families that are like maybe non-conventional, but they're there together for the holidays and everyone loves each other. And a family member wants to step up and maybe drunkenly mark the occasion. But they don't have any of the emotional language required to do anything, mm-hmm. and everyone's just kind of awkwardly like, oh, when's grandma going to sit down? Or when is Aunt Kathy going to stop this? Like, it just perfectly captures that, I thought. Then,
one of my favorite moments was her catching her sister's husband? Fiance?
I think it's married.
Husband. Yeah. Is it husband? Okay, catching her sister's husband drinking. And just what an absolute shit this guy is. He is one of the worst human beings I've ever seen. How are you going to make this all about you? I'm interested in seeing it.
Especially since, like, the one thing I got from the previously on is he absolutely initiated a romantic encounter on her, and then she did the right thing, told her sister, and then he threw her under the bus and said, well, who are you going to believe, me or your crazy sister?
And so they had this falling out, and it feels like a little bit of a coming together here in this first episode.
Yeah, it's a year flash forward from that event, and they are pretending to be together for the sake of their father. Or like pretending to be
But I do feel like there's a path forward for them, especially with this guy being shown to be a complete asshole and liar.
Yeah.
And I think she knows that because she's going home alone, right? She's not leaving with this guy.
Right. Going to the hospital now.
Oh, yeah. The hospital alone, yeah. So I assume that, like, she has acknowledged that, okay, maybe this guy has lied to me. And I'm interested to see how the sister relationship progresses from here.
Yeah, and like a lot, like Russian Doll before it, I feel like it's heading to a trajectory where it's very funny and very real, but also gives people kind of like, hey, there's a path forward. Like, this doesn't have to be your life. You can, and I felt like, I don't know what this person's path is in season one, but it feels like she's kind of a mess of a character. But like, she was right on, like, her sister trying to swallow all of her grief and all of her pain she's going through and pretend like nothing's happening with this miscarriage that she suffers. Like, that's like the least healthy thing you can do. And, you know, maybe it's not great to blow that, you know, to disclose that information, but it's like, yeah, I don't know what I'd do. And she
it's a medical emergency, though. It's like, it's like choking, and you know how people get embarrassed when they choke and they're actually dying in a restaurant,
right?
Because
but you still do the Heimlich regardless of whether they want you to or not.
Right.
Yeah, it's great because, like, I was thinking, like, God, what the hell is going to happen when they sit down? And somehow they found the most awkward way to deal with it possible. Like, I thought she's just going to spill the beans, but somehow she, like, started to, but then made it about herself, and then just made commentary about her sister's crazy decisions by framing it about me. It was like, oh, I'm going to be the most passive-aggressive asshole. I'm going to deal with this most passive-aggressive anal way possible, you know?
Yeah,
it just really, really worked for me.
Yeah, it was good. And everyone else was, you know, had been drinking enough that that all that nuance was lost on them on what was actually happening.
Uh-huh.
And
God,
all of that led into the most hilarious accidental punch fight I've ever seen on TV.
Well, especially since the guy was being vicious towards the sister, which he thought was like going to be something his wife would enjoy. But he didn't realize that he's actually saying things are incredibly vicious and insensitive
about his wife,
to just women, like any like woman in general, but like specifically his wife. And then it leads to, like you said, the fact that they, oh my God, the needy waitress, how they kept on like weaving that in the story until she ends up taking a punch at the end. It's just, it's really great.
Yeah, I like the show.
It's so good. I want to go back to season one and, like, you know, get that under my belt.
I took a little offense at them calling her a needy waitress
because she's a good waitress. Yeah,
she's pretty needy.
she's over attentive, but I like. Is that her fault, or is that the fault of our society and her managers? And, like, I don't know.
Well, I felt like you're also wait staff is like in that country where she's at.
Where is she? I have no idea where she is.
I think they're in London,
England,
right?
Somewhere.
Are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't. Do tipping over there?
No,
do they?
Okay. In that case, it makes a lot more sense.
Right. Yeah. That's what I got from it.
I also think
especially like when
to...
Claire got up at one point and then waitress runs over and she's like, do you think she'll need anything?
I also think there's like some things, like, you know, like couples that aren't very affectionate, like, seem like take ultra offense to seeing public displays of affection in others. Like, that's like a trigger for them. Like, oh God, why didn't they get a hotel room? Whereas like this family's emotionally closed off. So someone just kind of like being attentive and caretaking is like someone taking care of them well makes them feel weird. And it's like,
yeah,
you know, it's like if you're not a hugger and someone is, it feels weird, even though, like, this is a hug. This is human contact. Like,
right.
I thought there's a little bit of like, yes, they said that, but consider the source, you know, like.
Gotcha.
These people who all probably use therapy or have no frame of reference to call someone needy or well-adjusted or anything like that.
A little
that.
Bit of both.
Well, if they're all English, I get it.
Right. They're that even more buttoned down Americans.
Yeah.
Hey, before we move on, I want to talk about what's going on the rest of the week here at BaldMove.com. If you are a TV fan, and I know you are listening to BaldMove TV, we are covering Chernobyl every Wednesday. We have a full episode on the BaldMove TV feed which is this one. You might want to subscribe to it. It's a really great miniseries on HBO outlining the Chernobyl disaster and the Soviets' response to it. And it's just all the crazy shit and heroism that went on and stupidity that went on in the days after. We're also on the movie feed. There's a lot of activity next week. We've got a Wednesday Super Serious Film Fest coming out. That's the last one that we're doing in a celebration of Game of Thrones. This is, we're going to be doing a podcast on Willow. There's also going to be a John Wick 3 Parabellum review out next week, as well as a review of the new live-action Aladdin. So tons of action in the Bald Movies feed. Please subscribe to that as well if you'd like to keep up on it. And, of course, the big, the 800-pound gorilla, or the eight-season-long gorilla in the room is Game of Thrones. It's the final episode of the series. We have full coverage all week long, Sunday night, the instant take slash talk, Tuesday, the full podcast, and Friday, the spoiler edition. And we'll have an additional a week after this is all said and done, we'll have a wrap-up podcast to kind of send off the series in style. And that's what's happening here at baldmove.com. Muhammad Ali, say my name.
Muhammad Ali.
Say his name, not my name. I've only seen the first half of this. It's essentially a two episodes. They're 90 minutes apiece. The first deals with his life up through like his first comeback victory after he was sent to prison for dodging the Vietnam draft, or being a conscious objector to the Vietnam draft. And the second one, I presume, takes him all the way to the grave, because it does seem like the setup. It sets out to tell the story of Muhammad Ali from the time of him being a baby born in Louisville, Kentucky, in our backyard, until, you know, and the impact he had on society, in the sports world, in the world of politics and civil rights. I've seen a decent number of Muhammad Ali biopics and documentaries. What was your opinion on this one, Jim?
I like it, but not for the reasons that you would expect a Muhammad Ali documentary to hit, no pun intended. I think it's not a particularly great sports documentary, which it's made by HBO Sports. That's kind of the only reason I point that out.
Right.
But as a who was this man kind of documentary, I think it does a much better job. Because the highlights of his fights, I think, are so without context to be almost meaningless. The only things that really made sense in the context of this documentary as far as the fights go is when he loses a fight and when he comes back and regains the title. Those types of things, like seeing, you know, him fight Ken Norton for the third time or whatever, or some schmo that... you know, he had to climb this ladder back again is sort of pointless, and they don't dwell on anything long enough, which I guess is both a blessing and a curse, because if they did, I'd be saying, oh, it's even worse because they dwell on this too long and it doesn't mean anything. But I think where the documentary shines is showing what kind of man Muhammad Ali was.
Yeah, it puts a context, I think, for like non-boxing fans, like why he was so unique, because he had a very unconventional, like everything about it was unconventional, kind of like a stance, his defense.
I just don't think they do a great job. I've seen better boxing, Muhammad Ali boxing documentaries than this, way better.
Right. But I think that like a person that doesn't know anything about boxing and just wants to know why was Muhammad Ali such a... lightning in the bottle situation, you see this person and they contrast him to all the other boxers of the day, and just like he looks different, he moves different, his the way he runs his mouth, the way he brings in social commentary and says like just relentlessly smart things about it, you know, it's like I got as I was watching it, was like I kind of got it, like why that he was a key figure for civil rights. And I know a lot of people you know have some mixed feelings about like Nation of Islam and Black Muslims and some of that, the politics of that movement. But watching the first half of this, I'm like, if you're a racist white person, it's very hard to pretend that you are better than Muhammad Ali in almost any facet of life.
Sure.
Like, he's extremely good looking. He's powerful. He could kick your ass. He's also very smart. He's also
very rich. He's charismatic.
He's also ridiculously good looking when talk about it. Like, you know, you can talk about my defense, how well my hands are, but my face doesn't get hit. I've been in 180 fights and look how pretty I am. I'm as pretty as a girl. Like he just, He's like the Rock from his WWE days, yeah. Except for he actually can legitimately take you apart. Well, I'm sure the Rock could too, but
oh, me certainly. Yeah.
He's just like one of these one of a kind talents, and the way he would like fuck with people in the ring, and get in their heads in the pre and post fight stuff. And hold his own against kind of his white establishment sports media that was trying to take him down and trying to paint him as this uppity black man that, you know, is too good to fight for his country. But like all the things he said, like I thought it was really fascinating him coming back for the Olympics and talking about like, you know what, I just won the gold medal for my country, this yep. country that my daddy fought for in World War II, and I whooped the world for America, and I'm going to go to the best steakhouse in my hometown, and I'm going to celebrate, and I probably won't have to write a check, and they try to not serve him because yeah. he's black. And he's like, we don't serve Negroes. We're like, good, I don't eat them either. Give me my steak, you know? yeah. Like, he's just like, how the fuck can you argue with that? And seeing a guy like that on TV giving speeches into a sea of, like, white people, like, I feel like even if he wasn't politically active, just him living his life was kind of a rebuttal to some of the supremacy of the time.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that the second part of the documentary does so well is they... Because, you know, ultimately this ends up in a semi-tragedy, right? Like the tolls that boxing has taken yeah. on Muhammad Ali, or potentially even just his genetics cause mm-hmm. him to end up with a debilitating disease, Parkinson's.
Probably, even if it's one or the other, the combination, no good.
Yeah, definitely not. And so you can kind of see, like, the toll that takes on him. But I also think it was the toll of just having to stand up for his people constantly. Like he comes back from all of this stuff with the draft and stuff very much a different person, at least
yeah.
from what I can tell based on these interviews, which is one thing I appreciate about this documentary. It's all told through either the voices of interviews with him or his own voices or his own recordings, like family members, people who were close to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's these aren't contemporary review or interviews. Or like conversations they had with people who knew him in the past. These are of the era that they're trying to depict here.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helps to kind of lay out who he was at any given time, because you hear it in his own words.
Yeah.
But you see, like, this has taken a toll on him. He goes into this whole draft thing as kind of a bright-eyed kid
mm-hmm.
who you know, has had some adversity and some challenges based on his race and who he is and where he grew up.
Mm-hmm.
But I think more so, like, the whole weight of feeling like he has, like he is an icon, but also, I don't think he ever resents that, but I also think it takes a toll on him being forced to, you know, represent an entire people. And you can see that he's less of a boxer when he comes back.
Mm-hmm.
He at some point in the second half of this documentary, I think it's the second half, says, I don't like boxing. I don't want anything to do with boxing mm-hmm. when he's going through, like, his black Muslim phase. Or I don't even know if it's a phase, because at some point he comes back around to, like, oh, I'm actually the smart talking Muhammad Ali that I was when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, his physical abilities are sort of failing him. And
that's the thing, is like, as great as Muhammad Ali was, like, he had 5 years of his absolute prime stolen from him.
And I think that took a huge toll on him.
And also, like, I don't know, like, it seems to me, and I've said this several times, but it seems to me that, like, conventional wisdom is the Vietnam War was a bad idea and, like, a waste of resources and human lives, which makes, like, you know, so that's, like, a tragic in bulk, because, like, what, 68,000 some, maybe 90,000 service members gave up their lives, and 100,000 Vietnamese. But, like, this, like, personalizes, like, this is a thing you can point down to, like, the world, like, boxing wasn't, like, was changed. Like, the history of boxing is changed by this thing happening to Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, at the time, like, people were like, well, he's not patriotic, he's not willing to fight for his country. But history is judging him, like, he was on the right side. Nothing that he said was particularly out there. Like, he was saying things that I think are extremely true for both the time he lives in today, like a specifically criticism about Vietnam War and the fact that, you know, why would he go for a fight for a country that hates him and people like him and are mm-hmm. lying and tricking people and, you know, interfering in other countries' ability to do their business and try their own forms of government. He comes there like I feel like history's judged him correct, but he went through so much shit for it, saying what were correct things.
Mm-hmm. And he makes a point that, you know, I am doing much more of a service in the ring than I could ever do uh-huh. on a battlefield.
Uh-huh.
And he's right about that. Like, he says, every time I get in the ring, I'm fighting for this country. I'm fighting for this
right,
government.
Making, I'm making taxes and all that.
Yeah, I mean, but not even that, right? He's showing that the black men can be respected. That, mm-hmm. like, it's... He is doing, I think, far more good in the ring than he could have done holding a gun in the jungle.
Sure.
But the point I was trying to get around to is it's sort of a tragedy at the end, what happens to him with his Parkinson's disease. But he himself, in his own words, says, you shouldn't pity me, because as much as boxing has taken from me, it's given me 10 times that much back.
Yeah.
And it's given my people 10 times that much back. So, like, there's a message at the end, which it's hard not to look at it and say, oh, man, that's just such a tragedy. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he didn't look at it that way, and it's kind of, you know, uplifting that maybe we don't have to look at it that way too. And they go into like all the charity work and stuff, mm-hmm. and the you know, getting hostages back from Iran and all the things he did with like Jimmy Carter and Reagan and stuff, and the help that he gave people, mm-hmm. even after, you know, he was debilitated to the point where he could no longer box, he still had much more to contribute.
Yeah, and I thought there was some other interesting parallels that the documentary didn't make out of stuff that I noticed, is that, like, the people intentionally misnaming him just to be pricks
mm-hmm.
reminds me a lot of, like, the issue of, like, mispronouncing and dead-naming trans people.
Yeah.
Like, it's so clear to me that there's a certain class. I mean, there's some people that just aren't where they need to be in education. They just don't understand. But there's some people that are doing it and they know what they're doing, and they're just doing it to hurt people and disrespect people and make them feel like their choices don't matter. And I just got like a lot of deja vu, because the arguments these people are making about, like, well, that's what says on his birth certificate, and I'm going to, like, it is, you know, I understand they're not identical things. But I felt like there was a lot of similarity in the types of attitudes I've seen from people doing that, and the types of attitudes I see from people doing that in the trans community.
Yeah, I could see it from his opponents. Like, that's a tactic to get in his head.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you got trainers of other boxers that aren't fighting him, calling him Cassius, it's like, what the...
Oh, his attempt to, like, it's like, you know, like, oh, you are... And it's like a lot also came from fellow black athletes even.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, they're like, hey, I'm, they were contrasting, like, their willingness to be in the military service with his, and, you know, and I it's interesting, because, like, I think obviously Muhammad Ali generated a lot of press just as a promotion of himself. But, like, that stuff where he was calling some of those boxers, like, Uncle Tom, and got really heated, like, that felt like he, like... I felt like there's a couple times where you heard genuine emotion. Like, I'm not just fucking with you, man. Like, no, this is, like... You know, he's like, I don't hate the guy, but I don't like him because he's doing these incredible, like, he's refusing to say my name. He's making fun of my religion. He's making fun of my stances. He's carrying water for this government that, you know, won't serve us at restaurants, but wants us to go fight in its wars. Like, that's the time where it's like, and I think a lot of people smeared him in the time of, like, well, he's just doing, this is just part of his self-promotion. But, like, I felt like the documentary did a good job of showing, well, this is what Muhammad Ali looks like when he's just running his fucking mouth.
Yeah, when he's,
like, trying to generate interest in the fight and, like, putting in trying to get his opponent riled up. And this is him actually, no, you are actually hurting me and, like, you're trying to take down my human dignity. And I thought that was cool.
I would say probably the last thing I really have to say on this is Muhammad Ali's boxing career
mm-hmm.
is incredible.
Yes.
And if you look at this documentary and you go, like, oh, what's the big deal? I mean, he had a few comebacks. He lost a few fights. Go watch some of these full fights in their entirety, because the highlights that they show give you, like, a couple of big moments, but it's all about the lead up. Mm-hmm. It's all about, like, the context of the fight that you don't get from this documentary at all, and is what makes those fights so amazing.
Yeah.
I will understand, like, some people are not inclined to watch fights of any kind.
Sure.
And I'm not going to, you know, disparage you for that. But if you are interested, go, they're available, like, on YouTube and stuff. Mm-hmm. Go look up some of Muhammad Ali's bigger fights, like the Thrill Manila against, was that one George Foreman?
I think so.
Or was that Rumble in the Jungle?
That was all happened in part two, so I...
Yeah, yeah. I don't remember which it is. There's one fight where...
I don't know which one came first and which one came second, and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
When he starts to do his rope-a-dope stuff, there's one fight where I want to say it was maybe Rumble in the Jungle. I don't know, where they just beat the crap out of each other. And you look at that fight and you go, oh my God, if there's any fight that you could mark in Muhammad Ali's career that might have caused some injuries, this one is it. Mm-hmm. Because he's right, most of the time he doesn't get punched. But watch some of the ones where he doesn't and he just takes down his opponent. It's amazing. He's an incredible athlete.
He really is.
He is probably the greatest boxer.
Yeah.
And like, I haven't seen every boxer.
And there's this stuff, like, I hadn't seen a lot of his, like, Golden Gloves era stuff. And, like, when he was younger, just, like, a skinny kid throwing punches and working his way up to heavyweight and how his, like, you know, he honed his body to be like that. And there's just, and also his generation, it wasn't like that he was a giant amongst a bunch of like fucking jabronis. Like right. When they showed the pre-fight with Sonny Liston, and like you see Sonny Liston, he's like the fucking Incredible Hulk, just chopping dudes down, like just beating the fuck. And I'm like, even knowing like Muhammad Ali's going to win the fight, I'm like, Jesus Christ. Like, it just seems like I know a lot of people, like, you know, were rooting against Muhammad Ali and because, like, you know, he was a brash, outspoken black man. But there's a lot of people like, no, I just think this guy's going to be able to tear this guy apart. He just doesn't have the mass. He doesn't have the strength, but he's just so smooth and so quick and so hard to hit in his younger days. He actually was undefeated until he went to prison, right?
Yeah. And I think he came back off that 3-year break and he fought Sonny Liston for the first time and he lost.
Yeah. And it's like you could tell that he wasn't in his condition. Yeah. Like he probably, his mind wasn't in it. And
lost by decision. It's striking to me that you only ever see him hit the mat one time in this entire documentary. Because I don't think he's been knocked down very many times.
I did see a couple times where, that's the other thing that they didn't stop the documentary to point this out, but there, I saw a couple times in the first half where I know he took a concussion. Because he got wobbly in his knees and was like falling, and like they put him back in the fight, and he was still not upstairs fully.
Man,
and like when you see these old fights or like old football games, and like you're like, oh Jesus, they're breaking this person's brain, and they don't know it.
It's even worse in the second half of this documentary, where you know that Muhammad Ali is on the tail end of his career.
And he's just taking tons.
See him getting interviewed by Howard Cosell 3 days before the fight, and he can barely keep his eyes open. He can hardly speak. And you know 3 days later he's going into that ring against an opponent who is 15 years younger than him and determined to tear his head off. Mm-hmm. Somehow Muhammad Ali is able to get into that ring and hold his own and not get just absolutely devastated, but you know he's not. Yeah. He should not be in that ring.
Those hits are accumulating.
And the people around him putting him in that ring, although I will say they make this very clear that Muhammad Ali wanted to be in that ring.
Right.
There was nothing that could stop him, I don't think, from getting in that ring. If his manager said, no, we're not putting you in there, if his promoter said, we're not promoting this fight, he'd go find somebody else and he'd get in that fucking ring because he wanted to come back that fourth time. And it gets sad at the end, I think, but also hopeful because of his own words.
Do you think that will heavyweight boxing ever be good again? Because it seems like conventional wisdom is that, you know, now we know about traumatic brain injuries and concussions, that the quality of athletes that are going into there, like people from America just don't start boxing nowadays. You're getting a lot of people from like Eastern Europe and other parts of the world, like you know, Indonesia and Malaysia, places that, you know, like just not as well educated and have worse socioeconomic situations. Do you think that, like, and it seems like the UFC is also stealing a lot of its thunder and a lot of people promote that as a safer sport. I wonder if that's like that'll
without
be seen.
The gloves,
I wonder if that'll be seen like filtered cigarettes in a few years, because we don't know like what the long term effects of people, like, it seems like it's better than letting people get their brains beat out and putting people that are essentially functionally still knocked out and concussed, but putting them back in a fight. You know, like getting there's no safe amount of times to take severe blows to their head.
Yeah, no,
unfortunately.
I agree.
Unfortunately,
I actually like fighters like Manny Pacquiao, who are in lighter weight classes, because they are more technically proficient. They have to be, because those blows, you know, a guy who's 5'4" is not really going to be able to throw a punch to generate the power that can knock somebody out.
And they usually have better conditioning, and it's faster, and it's more cinematic, yeah. Like boxing.
Oh, it's I think it's so much more exciting.
Like this, like honestly though, some of these the fights of Ali's prime when he had top world class competition did surprisingly look like Rocky fights. Especially since Muhammad Ali had that like crazy casual defense where he just kind of keeps his hands down at like belly button level,
and he dodges you.
And you still can't hit punches on him, and he's like, it's so fucking crazy. But I don't know, like every once in a while you'll see a heavyweight guy like in the '90s. There's like Roy Jones Jr., which if you haven't seen his highlights, check those out on YouTube. All right, we will be back next week. We'll have a standalone podcast around Wednesday for this weekend's Chernobyl. We'll also be doing Bald Move TV next Friday with whatever our net drags up from the depths of the internet. Internet broadcasting,
those streamers,
streaming
services,
originals, the Hulus, whatever. Maybe the networks will get lucky one of these days and get something on there.
Good luck.
But we'll be back for that. Send in your feedback to tv@baldmove.com. Next week it's obviously a big week of Game of Thrones and lots of television. I think we got another movie. Check all that out on baldmove.com. Until then, I'm your host Aaron.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Cecily.
See ya.